From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Seated at breakfast in Brussels today, President Trump blasted NATO allies before anyone had touched their orange juice. He once again accused most NATO nations of not paying enough for shared defense. They'd pledged to increase spending by 2024 in case they had to protect each other from Russia, which had seized Crimea. But Trump blasted Germany for supporting a new pipeline to import Russian gas.
Germany, as far as I'm concerned, is captive to Russia because it's getting so much of its energy from Russia. So we're supposed to protect Germany, but they're getting their energy from Russia. Explain that. And it can't be explained, you know.
Here in this country, Republicans are pushing for a fast confirmation of President Trump's Supreme Court nominee, Brett Kavanaugh, while Democrats try to sink that nomination. Let's bring in our political strategist. Joining us today, Angela Rye, Democratic strategist. Hi, Angela.
Hi, Jeremy. How are you?
Doing well. And Alice Stewart, a Republican strategist, is with us as well. Hi, Alice.
Hi, Jeremy. How are you?
I'm doing good. So let's start with NATO. Here's an exchange between the Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg and President Trump at a breakfast this morning. As Robin mentioned, they hadn't even touched their orange juice. They're talking about the alliance, the pipeline, and the threat from Russia. Here it is.
I think that two world wars and the Cold War taught us that we are stronger together than apart.
But how can you be together when a country is getting its energy from the person you want protection against or from the group that you want protection?
Because you understand that when we stand together, also when dealing with Russia, we are stronger. I think what we have seen is that...
No, you're just making Russia richer.
Alice, you're a strategist. Is there a strategy here to what Trump is doing? Is he trying to... criticize allies ahead of his meeting with Putin next week because he's sensitive to criticism that he's too close to Russia, or what?
I think we always assume there is some strategy with President Trump, and we hope that there is. But clearly this was more of the same, which he has done before. The breakfast certainly got off on a difficult footing, but he's been consistent with where he stood with NATO and in wanting them to pay more for the defense spending. And evidently, there was a secret brunch after that breakfast, and they made some progress, given that they have all agreed to bolster the NATO's defense capabilities to counter Russian threat. So I think the optics of the breakfast and the audio we heard out of that was difficult and typical Trumpian style, but it sounds like they made some progress after the fact with the communique that came out of NATO.
Well, I just want to stay with you for a second, Alice, before we get to you, Angela, because a cynic could say, Jeremy, that when he speaks of Russia that way, that might have been, you know, in Russia whispering in his ear, hey, how come they're beating us up so much when they want our, you know, want energy from us, when they're actually playing with us? But how does this play out, this idea of him saying that the allies aren't spending as much when they are spending more? Why is he doing that?
This is something he has always been consistent on, and specifically with NATO, in that saying that the U.S. is not NATO's piggy bank. And that is something he's been consistent on. And look, if you look at the numbers, the percentage of our GDP that we pay into NATO is higher than the others. But we do have confirmation from them that they are going to boost their contributions to NATO. So that is encouraging. But this is something he has just, it's always been something that he has been firm about. And for some reason, it really is something he doesn't want to let go by. Even when they're right in front of his face, it's something he wants to clear up. And it sounds as though he's making some progress.
Angela, your thoughts on what we're seeing today?
Well, I haven't made it my business to try to determine what a Trump strategy might be. And part of that is because it's woefully inconsistent. I think the one thing we can always expect from Donald Trump is the desire to and the strategy to consolidate power, even if that means eliminating power bases for us in other spaces. So over the last year and a half, Donald Trump has spoken about NATO in ways that are less than constructive, that tear at, at least the Western Hemisphere's cohesion and unity. And I think it's deeply frustrating as you watch every day this country falling apart at its seams. So to go at it on a larger scale is just, I think, more maddening.
Well,
so I'm not making it my business to figure that out.
But his backers, Angela, might say it's working. You even saw the head of NATO
his
today.
Backers
well, hold on,
say
hold on.
That when
he, hold on one second, just one second, then you can jump. This morning you heard the Secretary General say to Trump at Trump's prompting, and this is partly because of your leadership that the countries are paying more. You know, he said that to them, that it started last year and it, you know, had something to do with Trump's bellicose nature. So they can point to that and say, look, it's working. Hello?
I'm here. I just, again, so I don't make it my business to understand what Trump supporters say is working or not. What I think is the real problem is his tough talk is going to cost us in a great way, more than it already has. And at some point, we have to understand that even if he got the short-term goal accomplished today, let's say that he does, what does it cost us in the long term? And I think that is the problem with his rhetoric. That is the problem with his approach. That very bullied way of dealing with people, with dealing with the world leaders, is going to backfire as if it hasn't already. So,
Alice, let's move to the Supreme Court here. And you tweeted that Brett Kavanaugh is a solid choice for Supreme Court justice. Is that a lukewarm endorsement or a full-throated endorsement?
It's a full-throated endorsement. Look, he is solid, in my view, for a lot of reasons. But most importantly, and this goes if I was Republican or Democrat, he has made a commitment, and we heard this Monday evening, that his number one commitment is fidelity to the Constitution and serving as a justice with a view of the Constitution as written. And I think that from an American standpoint, you can't ask for anything more than that in a Supreme Court justice. And he's got a long record, and it will be a very thorough and very tough a Supreme Court nomination process. But I think the current situation we're in, he was the best of the best. We had a tremendous, tremendous list of people to choose from. And in my view, this was the number one reason I voted for Donald Trump. I worked for Ted Cruz, who I view someone that would be bring civility and a mature atmosphere to the White House. When he didn't work out, Donald Trump is my choice solely on the purpose of the Supreme Court nominees, and he has followed through on those promises. And I see Brett Kavanaugh as someone that will show fidelity to the Constitution above all else, and that is critical. Not just because it's not a short-term thing. This could go on for many decades. So that's why I think he's a solid choice.
Well, Angela, take that up, because that is why a lot of people, we heard from evangelicals who held their nose and voted for Donald Trump for just this reason, to get this nominee in.
So, again, I think that this is, you know, just another point where we'll have to disagree. Brett Kavanaugh has demonstrated that he's very partisan. He's demonstrated that he will oppose voting rights. He supported a voter law that would suppress the vote of someone who is well into their 90s. He has demonstrated that he is not a fan of nor a supporter of laws that will advance civil rights in this country and make equity even tougher for communities of color after more than two centuries of oppression here. I think that that's deeply troubling, and it should come as no surprise to you that I adamantly oppose this justice. And I hope that Democrats, even in red states, will also do the same thing, because it's the right thing to do.
I was just going to ask you, what would you advise your strategist? What would you advise them? How do they go about that when they're in those delicate situations? And yet here's a justice who's, you know, people feel will probably overturn not just Roe v. Wade, but health care. How do they go about that?
I think they go about it by remembering the fact that they're elected leaders. And that means you decided to run with a particular party. You decided to run on the backs of progressive people, on people who want to see this country move forward and not backward. We've seen it go back a great deal since this president has been elected. And they have to decide that they're going to stand up for what's right. We don't deserve to go beyond 1965, where voting rights was enacted, or 1964 with Civil Rights Act was enacted, or even the 1968, since it's 50 years later, of the Fair Housing Act. We don't deserve to go backward. We must go forward. And so they have to stand on leadership and courage and be bold in this moment and do the right thing.
Just to follow up on that, the importance of this from a political standpoint is to encourage voters. Look, if you don't like this nominee, or this isn't someone that that you think would be reflective of your views and values, get out there and vote, and make sure you elect candidates on the local, state, and certainly the federal level that reflect your views and mm-hmm. values, because ultimately they will be the ones that are determining who these justices right. are at the Supreme Court, and it mm-hmm. makes a long-lasting impact.
Okay, just about a minute left here. Angela, let me go to you. There's a headline in today's Wall Street Journal that says, rising gas prices raise concerns for U.S. economy. People on average paying $2.96 a gallon now, much more where you're joining us from in California. Now, in 2012, Trump blamed President Obama for not stopping record high prices. Is he going to be blamed this time?
Who knows?
It doesn't sound very confident. Right.
No, I don't know. What I can tell you is I think that often we've seen this historically, that presidents are regularly blamed for rising gas prices, and many times they're outside of the scope of their control. I don't know what part of California you're talking about, but certainly in L.A., it's almost $4.
Right.
So
it's
very high. But yeah, I think that that doesn't not lie in his lap. As much as I want to make that a political issue, I'm not going to blame the president, just like I wouldn't let folks do that to Barack Obama.
Of course, there are some who say, environmentalists in particular, it should be high, make it higher so that we stop driving. Angela Rye, Democratic strategist, Alice Stewart, Republican strategist. Thanks. Both of you, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Vietnam War, or as it's called in Vietnam, the American War, ended in April 1975, but of course it continued for shell-shocked American soldiers and the Vietnamese, including the thousands of war babies born of relationships between American servicemen and Vietnamese women. They were called children of the dust. They were thrown into garbage cans. The U.S. brought back a few hundred in the early 80s, but Hanoi balked, said they were treated well, weren't refugees. Then in 1985, a photograph of a handicapped 14-year-old war baby on the cover of Time magazine moved U.S. students and their Congressman Robert Mrazek to bring the young man to the U.S. Then in 1987, Mrazek passed legislation to bring more. They briefly became popular at home because war babies were allowed to bring others who suddenly befriended them. But it's much more difficult for the 500 or so remaining right now, as our next guest will explain. Jimmy Miller is an Amerasian. His father was a U.S. serviceman who married his mother, a Vietnamese woman, before he had to flee Saigon. Jimmy now lives in Spokane, Washington, and is founder of Amerasians Without Borders. Jimmy, welcome.
Yeah, thank you, Robin, for the really nice introductions. Yes, this is Jimmy Miller from Spokane Valley, Washington.
Well, welcome to here and now. And what was it like for you when you were growing up?
Our life over there is very tragic, you know, because afterwards, the Vietnamese society seeing us as the blood of the enemy.
The blood of the enemy.
Yes. When American left, they turned their hatred on us. We get mistreated really badly. But, you know, like right now, I'm thinking about how do we go from here to the futures.
Well, before that, a little of your past. You came to the U.S. after that 1987 law. You met your father in 1995. It turned out he'd been wondering about you for years. He's since died. But what an incredible story.
Yes, it's an amazing story, and right now it seemed to me just like yesterday. I wrote the letter to American Red Cross. They asked for their help, but since I don't have any of my dad's Social Security, his address, except, you know, I have his photo and some letters he sent it to my mom, but without the return address. So they said, you know, we don't have any good information for them to trace my dad. So that's why I give up. And I thought, you know, maybe my dad already passed away. So I give up until 1994 when I get it ready for get marriage. And my sister, she thought she wanted to give me a gift for the wedding that I never forget. And then she worked at the public library in Spokane. There are only one envelope left with the postmark on it.
This is Fayetteville,
North Carolina.
This is a letter that your dad had mailed to your mom, Fayetteville, North Carolina.
Yes, they tried to call the public library in that area, and then might have my dad register for the public library in town. And my sister called.
So your sister called the library there and asked, you know, if he was registered. She found him. He traveled cross-country 27 years. You hadn't seen each other. And he met you, and it was joyous for him. He wanted to be with you.
Yes, yes. Right now I carry my dad's last name.
You carry your dad's last name, mm-hmm. and a picture of your dad and mom, who had gotten married. It's just they were separated by war. It's very sad, but lovely in the end that you met. And I thought it was so striking that your father's new wife was the product
yes.
of a German woman who had a relationship with an American serviceman. They'd also been separated after war, so she was very sympathetic. It's just amazing that this has repeated itself. But you knew how hard it was for you to find your own dad. So you've come up with a way for Amerasians who are left in Vietnam, there's hundreds of them, to come here more easily and get through the red tape to find their fathers. What was your idea?
You know, when I learned that Amerasian is still left behind in Vietnam, we spent about 5 years asking friends, the people from north, from central Vietnam in Hue, all the way to deep south. It took us 5 years to gather more than 500 persons on the list. Mm-hmm. These Amerasian, their application denied over and over because they have lack of proof from their father.
Let's explain that. Yes, now they have to have proof. We mentioned the 1987 law. You came under that law, but it's gotten much tougher for an Amerasian visa. You have to have an application with a detailed explanation, and a lot of Amerasians don't have any information about their fathers. Their mothers might have burned anything that they had because it was such a curse. So you came up with what idea?
I came up with ideas that, you know, how about we give them a DNA test, because a DNA test will tell the truth, there's no lie there. But at that time, the DNA kit is still very expensive, about like $1,000 a pop. So we have to wait until when the price going down. That's about $350 a pop in 2013. That's where we start the test Amerasian. And we have another obstacle because we cannot mail the kit to Vietnam or mail back to the United States. But we have to hand carry. We have to ask our friend hand carry like 20 or 30 kits. You know, like we have to smuggling the kit into Vietnam.
Oh, boy.
And we smuggling in and we smuggling back out. And the people wait at a coffee shop. And then we bring them in, a group of five. We test after five. That group walk out. We send out another group in. And we collect the DNA kit, the first wave of 100 kits. And we ask for donation among our group, our friends, Amerasians, you know, mm-hmm. my own money. Because we have no support from anybody.
Well, also, we want to give a shout-out to Family Tree DNA. That's a Texas group that is giving you a bit of a discount, but these kits are still enormously expensive. What kind of reception are you getting from the Amerasians in Vietnam? Do they want to know?
Yes, because this is our only option. We give it to them to prove yeah. themselves.
I have to say, Jimmy Miller, I have traveled to Vietnam, just loved traveling there. And it's so clear when you see an Amerasian. It's so clear with the blue eyes and blonde hair. It's so clear if they have African-American features. It's so clear when you see an Amerasian. But that's not enough, you're saying, for the U.S. government, for them to be able to get a visa.
Yes, that's a heartbroken right there. Like you said, you know, we clearly look different than a normal, ordinary Vietnamese people.
So the thing that made you a scourge, you know, that you looked different, you could not hide, that thing isn't enough to get people into this country now. And have you been able to bring Amerasians over after they've been tested?
There are another obstacle we have to jump. Right now, after we test, they only accept if we found the father or the siblings or at least like uncle or aunt. And then from there, we ask the family to try to obtain the DD-214 form, the military record. So we can use that DD-214. We submit with the DNA test to the U.S. consulate. Mm. And then there are another hoops we have to jump that even we found the dad, we found the siblings, U.S. consulate is still asking for the AABB accredited DNA testing through them. This cost us another $400, $500 before the U.S. consulate can approve them.
They want a second test.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if you want to do a shout-out to American servicemen right now who might be listening, who might be thinking, you know, I could maybe help here. I think I have a child, or I know. I mean, as you said, your parents were married in Vietnam. Would it help if U.S. servicemen reached out to you?
Yeah, a lot of Amerasian, they don't know even their mother. They when they were born, they were already thrown away to orphans. Mm-hmm. How can they prove with the U.S. government about their father?
Yeah.
After the war, 1965, now 2018, 43 years later, U.S. government still have the obligation to go back to Vietnam, gouging the dirt, looking for the remains of the missing in actions, while their children still in Vietnam, still alive, still walking on the face of the earth. That's why I lucky enough, I found my dad. I have a good family. I have a good job. But how about the Amerasian? We call them brother and sister. Mm-hmm. They still left behind. They are just like the people on a sinking ship. And I try to reach out and I help one by one. But how about the other? Not all 400 able to find their father. That's why I launched a petition. And I hope we have 100,000 signatures to the White House. And I asked President Trump, how he can help us to bring the children of Vietnam veterans, could be a children of the 58,000 men who gave their life. They could be a children of the missing in action.
They are America's children.
Yes. You know, bring our kids back home.
That's Jimmy Miller, founder of Amerasians Without Borders. His effort is to bring the several hundred, maybe as many as 500, children of American servicemen still in Vietnam. He wants them here in this country, working with DNA testing to try to do that. Jimmy, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Yep, thank you so much for having me.
And if you're an Amerasian in this country trying to bring somebody over, or a U.S. serviceman who's been bugged, as Jimmy's dad was, by someone you left behind, we have his information at hereandnow.org. We'll link you up.
The National Peanut Board is disappointed in Southwest Airlines, which announced that it will stop serving peanuts on flights as of August 1st. Another airline change announced this week, American Airlines will stop using plastic straws and drink stirrers in its lounges this month, and will stop using them on planes later this year. Joining us now is Seth Kaplan from Airline Weekly. Hi, Seth.
I don't think there's any snack that is as big a part of any airline's brand as peanuts were to Southwest. You know, they used to have peanuts fairs. There was a book called Nuts.
Really? About Southwest Airlines?
Yeah, exactly. So that was their thing, you know, and the peanuts fares, that was their way of saying, hey, we'll give you peanuts, not a lot else, but it'll be, you know, cheap and reliable. So yeah, they held on. As you said, not the first airline, you know, American and United have already done this, among others, but you can imagine them being a little more reluctant than others to go along with what has become a trend in the industry.
But how did they deal then with people who have peanut allergies?
Well, when somebody told them that they were, you know, highly allergic to peanuts, they wouldn't serve peanuts on that flight. Mm. That, by the way, is how Delta still handles it. Delta hasn't yet taken peanuts off, but they say, hey, if you have an allergy, just let us know and we won't serve peanuts on that flight.
Is it likely to impact Southwest bottom line to not be able to advertise that they've got free peanuts on board?
Highly unlikely. look, this is an airline that has its very loyal following.
Right.
There will be some people who will be nostalgic about the peanuts. But no, in the end, people are going to choose airlines based on the reasons they usually choose them.
Right.
Price, schedule, other things about service. Peanuts probably pretty far down the list.
So what about American Airlines deciding to move away from plastic straws and stirrers? They're going to eliminate, they say, 71,000 pounds of plastic a year. Of course, this follows Starbucks doing the same thing, getting rid of plastic straws by 2020. How big a change is that for an airline like American?
Yeah, another one of those socially conscious moves, one of those things you obviously wouldn't have seen years ago, but this is where the world is going. They probably saw, hey, this is going to happen, and so you might as well get out there in front of it and get the positive publicity that you get from being the first giant airline to do it in America rather than the second or third.
Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, another thing that airlines are worried about right now is fuel prices. A lot of people are seeing gas prices the highest in years, but airlines are also very reliant on, you know, a stable fuel price so that they can make money when they charge people for the tickets.
Yeah, you know, people who drive cars, when you see that price at the pump going up, you can bet that airlines also are paying more for what, for some of them, is the most expensive thing they buy. When you look at costs for airlines, labor costs, their employees, always very high. That's always one or two. And the other one that's number one or two, depending on how expensive fuel is indeed fuel prices. And when fuel prices start ticking up, you know, that means that the kind of airfares that airlines need in order to break even and make some money, well, that level tends to go up too. And so over the long term, it tends to push airfares up, even though it's not something that happens from one day to the next. And airfares are still right down near their historical lows in inflation-adjusted terms. But yeah, no question, it does pinch airlines and ultimately travelers.
That's Seth Kaplan at Airline Weekly. Seth, thank you.
Thank you, Jerry.
Let's get back to our top story, President Trump's trip to the NATO summit in Brussels. And let's get a European view from Ulrike Frank. She's a policy fellow with the European Council on Foreign Relations. Ulrike, President Trump has been very critical of NATO and European allies. Do you think he could go so far as to pull out of NATO entirely?
That is quite a question, isn't it? I mean, it's crazy that we're even talking about this. I don't expect that at this point in time, but it is very clear that over the last few years, the time really of Donald Trump's administration, the United States and its allies have been alienated more and more, and it's harder and harder to make the case for the transatlantic friendship.
What about President Trump's point that European allies ought to contribute what they have said that they would, which is 2% of their GDP for defense? Why is that so difficult for some of these countries, rich countries in Europe like France and Germany, to do?
Yeah, so the 2% GDP point has become very important. So just to give a bit of background on that, so NATO, I already in 2002 agreed that it would be good if all NATO members would spend about 2% of their GDP on their national defenses. And, you know, some countries do, some countries don't. And in 2014, when Russia annexed Crimea, NATO, you know, reminded its allies, its members, that they should spend that kind of money. And they wrote it down in the Wales Summit Declaration that says that within a decade, so until 2024, NATO members should try to spend that much money. So it is in no way a kind of set commitment that all members have to meet now, but it is a guideline. And it is true that not all member states of NATO do meet that target. The reason why it is so difficult is simply because, you know, this is quite a lot of money, especially for the big countries such as Germany, which you mentioned. And in Germany in particular, there are still some historical reasons why we don't like to spend that much money on defense. And the question, of course, is, you know, to what extent is this necessary? What should this money be spent on? Does it really make sense to link it so much to the input, i.e. the 2%, and shouldn't we rather look to the output? Generally, I do agree that Europe and, you know, overall should be spending more money on defense. But I don't think it's a great idea to kind of play out the allies in the way that the U.S. president is currently trying to do.
Why not? He clearly thinks that he's going to get results by doing that.
It's interesting, though, because I'm not entirely sure what kind of results he's hoping to get. Or let's phrase it another way. I hear a lot in Europe that a lot of countries are thinking that the only reasons why the U.S. president is emphasizing the 2% so much is that he's hoping that European allies might buy American equipment. I'm still not entirely sure what he's trying to achieve, especially, and it's important to emphasize this, given that the European NATO members are all increasing their defense spending. And for a few years, this has very little to do with Donald Trump. U.S. presidents have said for quite a long time that NATO members should spend more, and all of them are. So defense spending is rising, including in Germany, that is going to hit 1.5% within the coming years. So things are moving in the right direction, which is good.
President Trump has directed the Pentagon to review the impact of pulling troops out of Germany. Do you think he'll follow through on that? And what do you think the impact would be?
Yeah, that was also quite interesting news, especially from a German point of view. So the latest I've heard is that the Pentagon has actually said that they're not specifically looking into this. So it's not entirely clear whether this is still the current plan of looking into pulling out the about 35,000 active duty troops out of Germany. The thing is, what is extremely important to emphasize is that most of these troops, the big majority of these troops, aren't there to guarantee German or European defense. Rather, in Germany are many, many installations that the U.S. needs as staging grounds for its operations in the Middle East and in Africa. So as an example, the U.S. Africa Command is based in Stuttgart in mm-hmm. Germany. This has nothing to do with German security or European security. Also in Germany is Ramstein Air Base, which you may have heard. And every single U.S. drone operation in the Middle East is done through Ramstein. So if, you know, the U.S. president were to close these installations, the U.S. military would have massive problems. There's also a great hospital in Landstuhl in Germany where most, if not all, of the casualties from Iraq and Afghanistan are being sent. So these are all installations that may be based in Germany, but they contribute very directly to U.S. national security interests. So pulling these out, again, would just not be in the U.S. interest, and it would hit the U.S. at least as hard as Germany.
I noticed that President Trump called Russia a competitor. He's also called the European Union a competitor.
Yeah, and that is one of the biggest changes for me, really, with this new administration, that allies are no longer seen as allies and friends, which you can, of course, have disagreements, as it is normal, but as competitor, if not even enemies. I mean, which is quite concerning, of course, for the U.S.'s allies.
That's Ulrike Frank, who is a policy fellow with the European Council on Foreign Relations. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Each year when the weather warms up, Natural Resources departments stock community lakes and ponds all across the country with fish. The idea is to let people in urban and suburban settings connect with the environment. Judy Fays from the Mountain West News Bureau reports.
Willow Pond is like a lot of community fishing holes. It's in an urban park just outside Salt Lake City, beyond some soccer fields and a big baseball diamond. Great blue herons stand around, a pair of pelicans, too. They seem oblivious to the racket from the nearby highway.
Daniel, do you like catching fish?
Uh-huh.
Antonio Cadena is fly casting. His son Daniel is 2.5. He's giving his spinning pole a rest.
Do you like big ones or little ones?
Big one, Dad.
Father and son spend a few mornings a week here.
I just want to make sure that he gets outdoors and that he doesn't grow up just watching TV all day every day. So he comes out here, he'll play with the ducks, and when we occasionally catch a fish or two, he likes to touch them and throw them back.
Or take them home so they can be simmered in garlic butter and he can eat them.
I think it's good for him.
At the parking lot, a few men huddle in the shade, coffee cups in hand.
There's a lot of us old retired guys that this is an outlet for us.
Jerry Weaver comes here most days.
Sometimes we fish, sometimes we just talk, you know, and we just hang out.
They talk about fishing when they were kids, how they'd spend long summer days outdoors, how their dads taught them.
It's kind of a family thing, too, you know.
That's fellow retiree and fishing buddy Glade Charlesworth.
Keeps families together and keeps them off the street, keeps them from crime and stuff.
They refurbish fishing poles from a thrift store. They use them to teach kids who come along and want to learn to fish. They call it giving back, but they also just get a kick out of it, you can tell. A boxy truck with a huge trout painted on the side rolls up to the pond. Inside are thousands of rainbow trout from the state hatchery.
I'm going to put 1,400 fish into the pond.
Ryan Arthur is an aquaculturist for the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources. A small crowd watches as he climbs to the truck's side and dunks a big net into a hatch on the top of the tank. Arthur strains backward to lift a net full of flopping fish. He twists the net upside down. Around 50 rainbow trout splatter into the pond.
Here in the city, we're kind of disconnected from, I think, a lot of the environment.
But you can bring them to a park like this, explain to them, you know, the fish do need ideal water quality in order to survive. And I think it's a great way just to explain that and explain what habitats are. And
scenes like this are playing out in many states, including Colorado, Montana, and Idaho. They also stock community fishing holes in the spring and summer. The fish might not be wild, but the conservation group Trout Unlimited supports programs like these.
That thrill of feeling the fish bite and then reeling it in and admiring the fish.
That's Brett Prettyman with Trout Unlimited.
It's just an easy way to connect with nature in an urban environment and makes them want to pursue it when they get older and when they have the opportunity to actually get into nature in the wild and experience it out there.
That's exactly what's happening at Willow Pond. The Cadenas are back on the fishing dock.
That's got one. Get taken.
It's not fishing on a wilderness river or the ocean, but it gets people hooked on being outdoors. For Here and Now, I'm Judy Fakes.
A study released this week concludes there might be a new key to fighting aging, at least in mice, as part of a field called senolytics. This is the study of small molecules that can possibly selectively kill off old cells. The research found that removing old cells from mice increased their lifespan. Sharon Begley is senior science writer with our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. Hi, Sharon.
Hi, Robin.
Well, I'm sure you're having all your friends say, where can I get this? But there are cautions as well. So first, tell us more about the study. There have been other ways that researchers have looked to mice and preventing aging. So what's happening here?
Oh, my goodness, yes. The studies in the field of anti-aging just keep coming. And so many of them have a sort of aura of quackery that when I first started looking into this one, I was skeptical, to say the least. Mm-hmm. But as you described, senolytics is the area of anti-aging research which looks at whether removing old cells, which are called senescent cells, might in fact roll back the calendar and make animals young again. And so when you first think of that, at least I did, I thought, you know, if you take out my old cells, there's going to be nothing left of me. So how could this possibly work? However, it turns out that even in super elderly humans, so let's already jump to humans from the mice, only about like 7% of our skin cells are senescent. And that's the highest percentage of any organ. So at least you don't have to worry that you'll be left with, you know, holes in your heart and your brain and your kidneys and whatever. We actually don't have that many senescent cells, but they are so toxic that even getting rid of those few of them might have really positive effects, well, at least if the mice research works.
Talk about why they are so toxic, not just because they're, you know, old cells lying around, but because they what they do to new cells. So,
right.
So why are they so bad?
Right. So, yes, they are not pulling their weight in whatever organ they happen to be a part of. But worse than that, they secrete compounds that not only kill the young cells around them, which mean those cells are not working as they should in, you know, the heart or the brain or the kidney or their skin, etc., but they are also sending out toxic compounds that prevent the stem cells, the progenitor cells, whatever you want to call them, these cells that make new heart cells, kidney cells, brain cells, etc. They are putting the brakes on the production of new young cells, which is what keep us going. So these senescent cells really pack a double whammy, which is why even though they are few in number, their effects are outsized. And that's what has made scientists think, well, if we could just kill them, that might have, again, outsized effects on the health and lifespan of an animal.
As you say, they punch way above their weight in what they do to the cells around them. And there's something that's starting to sound creepy about this. I mean, these poor old cells who've done a good job and now are failing, you know, to be removed. But it's in the effort of extending the life or extending the quality of life. How do you remove them?
So there are, in fact, compounds in the study that was released this week. One is a leukemia drug, who would have guessed. The other is quercetin, which is a compound that's found in a lot of fruits and vegetables. But the scientists told me that they have at least a dozen others in the pipeline. So it turns out that you can selectively kill the senescent cells, and you leave the healthy ones alone. And that, of course, is the goal. And this stuff, although we have to keep emphasizing that this research was in mice, there are already companies that have identified other compounds that can eliminate senescent cells, and they are already in human studies in clinical trials with some of them. So the research is really just barreling ahead.
But even some of the researchers you spoke with who are behind the mice studies aren't taking these quercetin supplements. Why, if they're seeing what it can do in mice?
Yes, I always ask a scientist that, you know, if the scientist has identified something that seems to, you know, be beneficial, I say, so are you going down to your local health food store and buying a bottle? And the reason James Kirkland, who's at the Mayo Clinic and who led the study, said no, is that we don't know what a safe dose is. Until the human studies are done, do not just start popping, you know, quercetin or any other compound. You should continue to eat as many fruits and vegetables as possible, but do not take the supplements.
And just talk for a second about it. It's not just extending the life of the mice, but they were more spry.
Right. So lifespan is something that I think we all understand. But a sort of new term that's been injected into, you know, the discussion is health span, which simply refers to the fact that, you know, if I came to you, Robin, and said I have a way to make you live to be 90 or 95 or more than 100, you might say, wow, great, give it to me. But then your second thought might be, well, hold on, if it's going to be an extra 10, 15 years where I'm not ambulatory, where I can barely function, where I need help to live, maybe, you know, you can keep it. So that's what health span is, that being active and engaged in everything else, even in the latest years of your life. Anyway, so in the mice, at least, not only was lifespan extended by 36%, but in those extra months, in the case of a mice, it would be years in the case of people, they were able to run on a treadmill, walk quickly, their grip was strong, all the things which, again, humans lose as well as they age. So this is at least a little glimmer of hope that if you can keep people alive longer, it will not be at the expense of their health.
Okay, we shall see. Sharon Begley, senior science writer at STAT, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Seems like the message in each story about living longer is eat healthy, exercise, don't smoke.
Or, man, wait for those supplements to be okay. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.